Thus tonight, Eric Marcus, who is the author of a fascinating book called Making History, The Struggle for Gay and Lesbian Equal Rights. It came out last year. It is doing quite well. And Eric Marcus is in New York. We're talking to him in New York right now. He is a former producer for both CBS Morning News and the other one.
Good Morning America.
Good Morning America, yes.
Yeah.
Tell us, describe the book for us, Eric.
Well, it's, I should also point out it's due out this June in paperback.
That was going to be one of my next questions. Go ahead.
Just ahead of you there. It's a collection of 49, the stories of 49 different people, and through these stories, I try to give readers a sense of the struggle for gay and lesbian equal rights from 1945 to 1990. And I traveled from Juneau, Alaska to Key West, Florida to talk to these people. And they range from a secretary in Los Angeles who published a little newsletter for lesbians in 1947 to Dear Abby, the famous purveyor of common sense advice. All kinds of very interesting people, and they tell their personal stories as well as their involvement in the struggle for gay and lesbian equal rights.
Well, those were, you mentioned two of the people that I was going to ask you specifically about. So why don't we go ahead and start with it. The first one is the secretary. I guess she went by the, she still goes by the pseudonym, is that right? Lisa Ben?
Well, I call her by her real name whenever I talk to her. Mm-hmm. She's now in her 70s. And Lisa Ben is her pseudonym. And if you play around with the letters, you see the word, it's an anagram for lesbian. She's afraid that if her elderly relatives somewhere in the Midwest find out that she's a lesbian, that they'll be very upset by it. So honoring her request, I still refer to her by the name Lisa Ben. That's a pseudonym.
Okay, tell us a little bit about the kind of things that she did. I'm fascinated. I was fascinated by the newsletter that she printed out. I guess she called it a magazine.
She called it a magazine, yeah. When she was a secretary for Hollywood, I think it was a Hollywood producer.
What years were these?
Mid-1940s. And it was in 47 she was working for this one producer who said he didn't have enough work to keep her busy full time, but he wanted her to look busy. And she said, well, I had a typewriter, I had time, and I wasn't supposed to read. She said, so what else do you do? You write a magazine for lesbians. And so she would, write essays and reviews. She said there weren't many books then to write about, so she chose some that had been around for a while and wrote reviews of those. And she would type this newsletter through twice using five sheets of carbon paper each time.
Because that was before Xeroxes, huh?
Long before Xeroxes. Oh, and she said she couldn't take it to a printer in those days. So even if she had wanted to make multiple copies, no one would have printed the material because it was considered obscene. And later she learned how dangerous it was for her to even put this in the U.S. mail. Because just talking about homosexuality in a positive way was viewed by many as obscene, and in later years, when there were indeed gay and lesbian magazines, the U.S. Postal Service did impound various issues of some of the first gay and lesbian magazines for speaking about homosexuality in a positive way.
Well, how many people were able to read these magazines if she only printed 10 at a time?
Not a lot. What she did is she passed them on to her friends, and she asked them to pass it on to their friends. So I suspect that at most, only a few hundred people ever saw, and that's probably being generous, a few hundred people maybe saw her newsletter.
Are there any of those left around? Are there still?
Yes, she has a full set of them, and there's a full set with the, there's a gay and lesbian archives in Los Angeles.
Uh-huh.
And there's a full set there. She wrote one essay that I quote in the book, which is so remarkable to me because she talks about her hopes for the future,
mm-hmm.
about a day perhaps when there may be, real gay and lesbian magazines on the newsstands. When the characters of some of the lesbian novels would step from the pages of the books that she'd read and maybe they'd be on the silver screen. And the things she talked about are many things that have come to pass, but she said she never imagined that she would live to see that day. And now she lives by herself in relative obscurity in a small bungalow that she owns, that she's very proud of, that she paid for with the money she earns as a secretary, with her 15 cats. And is largely forgotten.
Yeah. We'll talk about some of the other characters, or not characters, people,
yes.
in a little while. But first of all, I want to talk a little bit about the dates. A lot of people assume that this whole gay, lesbian, and civil rights movement started in 69 with Stonewall, yet you go back to 45. Why 45? And tell us how you feel about Stonewall.
Well, I chose 45 because that's the end of the war, and from all the research I had done, it seemed that the first organizing, the early discussions about even forming these kinds of organizations took place immediately after the war. There have been tremendous dislocations of people during the war. Millions of Americans moved to the port cities and were shipped out from the port cities. They went to the cities for work in the war industries, and they went off to the military. And it was the first time many, many gay and lesbian people had a chance to discover that there were others like themselves. They discovered this in a lot of the bars and restaurants in these major cities. It was out of these dislocations that grew the first organizations in the early 50s. So I begin then, and what was startling to me was to discover that there was a history before 1969. Before I did this book, I had no idea that there was anything before 69, because everything I had read in the mainstream press and in the gay press talked about, they would say things like, when the gay rights movement began in 1969. And that's been repeated so often that it's almost considered fact, and I still read it to this day, and it makes me crazy, given that I know that it wasn't the beginning. Mm-hmm. By 1968, for example, there was a national convention of 40 gay and lesbian organizations. It was held in Chicago. And that was the year that the slogan, "Gay is Good," was adopted as the official slogan of the gay rights movement. Mm-hmm. So there was plenty of history before Stonewall. And what came after Stonewall, all of the organizing, could never have occurred without what came before. The initial meeting that was held in New York after the Stonewall riots, which was, for those people who don't know, was a riot that followed a police raid at a gay bar in Greenwich Village in New York. That meeting that was held immediately following was sponsored by the Mattachine Society, which was a local gay organization, and the people who formed one of the early gay liberation groups out of that meeting were from the Daughters of Bilitis and from the Mattachine Society.
We're speaking with Eric Marcus, the author of a book called Making History, The Struggle for Gay and Lesbian Equal Rights. Could you tell us, Eric, how difficult it was to find these people and to find the information on these people? I mean, surely the straight press was not writing about it back then, was it?
No, it wasn't easy. Fortunately, I had the work of people like John D'Amelio, who wrote a book about the gay rights struggle from 1940 to 1970, so I depended upon his research a lot, and then developed a timeline from some of the early gay publications, Gay Community News and The Advocate, beginning in the late 60s, early 70s. But there were specific people I knew I wanted to find, and one of the challenges was that a lot of them went by pseudonyms. So Lisa Benn, for example, who I read about in John D'Amelio's book, I knew I wanted to find her, but it took about 30 phone calls to find her, and several months. If I had known who to call first, I would have found her on one phone call. But even once I found people who knew her, they were reluctant to give me her phone number.
So you had to play detective in addition to being a researcher.
Oh, I did. I really felt like a detective. And to give you an example of how I found one man in the Midwest who asked me not to identify him by name or location, I was in Denver. Well, before I went to Denver, I called some friends of mine who owned a gay lesbian bookstore in Denver. And I said, have you heard of, I think the name was Carl Harding. It was a pseudonym of a guy who was involved in the Mattachine Society in Denver in the late 50s. And I said, oh, Carl Harding, we know him, but that's not his real name. And they told me what his real name was, and they said, here's his phone number. And I called him, and he said, oh, well, if you come talk to me, you should talk to these six people. And one of those six people turned out to be a guy named Paul Phillips. That's not his real name, who had a remarkable story to tell, and his story begins in 1919, actually a little bit before that. In 1919, his parents took him to the Mayo Clinic to be diagnosed as a homosexual. They were hoping he wasn't, but that's what he was diagnosed as. So that's how I found him. So often when I called people, it would lead from one to the next to the next to the next. Mm-hmm. But there were also certain name people who I wanted to talk to.
Well, one of them was Evelyn Hooker, Dr. Evelyn Hooker. To me, that was one of the most interesting chapters in there, her story. Can you tell us a little bit about her? There's a lot of people who are not familiar with her.
Yes, I had never heard of Dr. Hooker before. There's now a documentary that's been done about her, and it'll be on PBS, I hope, this fall.
Wasn't it nominated for an Academy Award?
Yes, it was. I just read about that, and I've seen it. It's a wonderful documentary. Dr. Hooker did the first comparative study between gay men and heterosexual men to discern whether or not homosexuals were indeed mentally ill. Up until that time, it was simply assumed that gay people were mentally ill. No one had ever done a scientific study before. What's so remarkable about what she did is that the climate was not exactly ideal for this. This was the McCarthy era, for one thing, and she was government-funded for her research. Her research was government-funded, I should say. And it was dangerous for her career. Surprisingly, though, she said she had no trouble finding gay men. One of her gay friends was the one who encouraged her to do this work. She had no trouble getting gay men for the study, but she had a hard time finding straight men who would be willing to participate in this sort of thing. And her conclusion was, and this was, her results were studied by a number of impartial judges, her conclusion was that there were no psychological differences between gay men and straight men, period. And that was considered very, very radical in that, at that time. And her study led eventually to the change, the decision by the American Psychiatric Association to change the listing of homosexuality as a mental illness. Her work was pioneering and very, very, very critical. She's now in her mid-80s. She lives in Los Angeles. And some people refer to her as the Rosa Parks of the gay rights struggle.
Right.
Even though she's a heterosexual person.
That was going to be my question there.
Yeah.
One other person before we talk about Dear Abby. Carolyn Mobley, right here out of Houston.
Yes. Carolyn, I was originally not looking for Carolyn. I was looking for somebody else. And in my search for someone else, the man I spoke with said, well, if you haven't talked to Carolyn Mobley, you've got to talk to her. Carolyn Mobley comes from a very religious family, Black Baptist church, and she always knew she wanted to be a church educator. And her story is so gripping because it's about how one person has come to grips with both the love of her religion and love of self. She learned to accept herself and reconcile that with her religious beliefs. Had to leave the church she was involved with because she had a church job and was fired because she was lesbian, and is now a Metropolitan Community Church minister in Houston.
Okay, now tell us about Dear Abby. Why in the world would she be in this book?
Well, years ago I read a little clip about something Dear Abby once wrote. One of somebody had written her and said, well, we have these awful people who moved in next door. The men have long hair, the women have short hair. And Abby said that from the description, it was obvious that these were gay and lesbian people. And this woman who wrote her said, what can we do to improve the neighborhood? Because she was upset by having these people next door. And Abby wrote back simply, you could move. And I was so impressed by that, I thought I'd call Abby and find out what she'd written on the subject before. And it turns out she had been writing for years, since the late 60s, on this issue.
And actually, one of her first letters that she responded to was from Houston, wasn't it?
I believe so. Yeah. I believe so. And she was adamant in her belief that there was nothing wrong with gay and lesbian people, that the parents should love them, the parents shouldn't feel guilty. And I would say she was probably one of the first heterosexual people with that kind of stature to come out in support of the rights of gay and lesbian people. Mm. And she's gotten thousands and thousands of hate letters over the years for her support. And I thought she has an important place in the struggle. I think she's made as much of a difference as I think she and Phil Donahue and perhaps the show Dynasty have done more to educate Americans on the subject of homosexuality than any other people or subjects.
Okay, we're running out of time here, but I want to give you an opportunity to tell us about your other books. Tell just briefly, or just tell us what your first book was.
My first book was The Male Couples Guide, which is a practical guide for gay couples, for male couples. Just out in a new edition recently. I wrote a humor book in between called Expect the Worst, You Won't Be Disappointed, which I think has been the case with some of the gay rights struggle and the kinds of prejudice we encounter. And I have a new book coming out shortly. It's called, it'll be out in June. It's called Is It a Choice? Answers to 300 of the Most Frequently Asked Questions about Gay and Lesbian People.
Okay, well, we hope to talk to you about that when the book comes out. And I understand you might be in Houston as part of the promotion. I hope we can have you here in the studio.
I would be delighted, Juan.
Okay. We have just a few more seconds. Is there going to be a follow-up to this Making History, or is this it for you here?
No, I think not in print, but I'm hoping that I'll be working with a friend soon on a radio piece for National Public Radio using some of the clips of the actual tapes.
That's sort of unusual for National Public Radio. They haven't done that much on gays and lesbians, have they?
They do a fair number of reports, but this kind of documentary piece, no. But they haven't decided yet whether or not they're going to do it, so we'll see. I'm hoping, actually, I've been talking with a number of people about doing a documentary based on Making History. and that would be very exciting to do.
Yeah, that sure would be. We'd sure love to see it. Well, listen, Eric, thanks a lot for speaking with us, and we hope to see you soon.
Thank you, Juan.
This is Juan Palomo with Lesbian and Gay Voices on KPFT.